It's like The Shawshank Redemption, but with a lot more tunneling through shit and no fucking redemption. Hello, everybody. It's the Anarchy and Culture Podcast, and I'm here today with...
Michael Gillum.
Joe Mangum.
And Jason Gillum.
All right.
And we're back.
And we're back. By popular demand. Two people.
This is the second. Your mom? I only saw one person.
Two people have mentioned it on Twitter, and we did get a second review after my review on iTunes.
Hey.
Yeah.
A real review.
I don't trust it. I think there's an ulterior motive there. I think it's an agency plant. Anyway, today we're talking about The Thick of It, a BBC series. Anybody got a good way to encapsulate what this show is about? That's a good one.
The Thick of It is the anti-West Wing.
I've heard that. That's a really good way to describe the show. I mean, they're different genres. West Wing is a drama, an American political drama. This is a British comedy, so...
Political satire.
Yeah, political satire. Basically, it's... Sorry, I should apologize. I've got a kind of cold flu thingy, so my voice is kind of fucked right now.
He's dripping more than a yoked up homecoming queen.
What?
Okay.
Yoked up.
It's a very sweary show, so we're going to be extra fucking sweary today.
There's a lot of fucking swears.
Yeah.
It is competitive with Deadwood for our most sweary subject matter.
Yeah.
Yeah, we talked about having a fuck ticker, but I think it would break after a certain time with this show. So not for the kids, ladies and gentlemen at home.
Yeah, well, this show is not...
Even without the swearing.
Yeah.
Also, I should mention that The Thick of It is available on Hulu if you're interested in watching the show, so you can watch them. I think all of them, except for two specials online.
Yeah, except
for
the two specials that come between seasons 2 and 3.
Actually, the one we just watched was on Hulu, so maybe couldn't find the other one.
Okay.
But anyway, to get to what the show is about, it is a political satire. It's focused on... a department of the British government, and I didn't look into whether it was a specific analog to this department. In the show, it's called the Department of Social Affairs, later changed to Social Affairs and Citizenship.
DOSAC. Which is
a
made-up thing, but I'm not sure if it's equivalent to any real British department.
It seems like kind of a catch-all to shove a bunch of shit that they don't...
Yeah.
That is not that important to them, I guess. They deal with crime statistics and immigration... stuff, and basically
all the shit that actually affects people's day-to-day life.
Right.
This one shitty department that is underfunded and perpetually in crisis.
They're the joke, the running joke of all the other departments. They are the shit department.
Yeah, and it's, but most of what they seem to do is PR. It's a lot of meet and greet shit and, like, spinning stuff, which is what the central idea of this show is. Like, let's look at the PR aspects of government and how they interact with the media. Basically, the show is about all this political one-upsmanship and this game being played between politicians and the press, with the voters and the common citizen basically kind of left out of in the cold. And the show stars, I think we can fairly characterize Malcolm Tucker as a villain protagonist.
Yeah.
Much in the same way that we talked about Deadwood on this show, much in the same way that Al Swearengen is, except maybe certainly less heroic. Because
Al Swearengen is definitely a anti-hero.
Right.
Whereas Malcolm Tucker is probably just a very likable villain.
Right. And so there is an arc over the show of his political career, I guess. I guess I should describe what Malcolm is. He's referred to as the enforcer. He's the communications director for the prime minister. His job is to make sure the ministers of the various departments stay on point and are following the party line.
He's the Rahm Emanuel or
yes.
Karl Rove.
Exactly.
The David Axelrod
of the Liberal Party and British politics.
And also to deal with the press, which basically means threatening to, you know, rip their cocks off and stuff their balls up their asses.
As well as blackmail and coercion.
Pretty much anything that's corrupt falls under his as Ledger Domain.
So he's also been referred to as the all-swearing eye.
Yeah. So, what do you guys want to talk about? How should we get into this?
Yeah, just to give my... I'm kind of a later comer to the show, and I've only seen... In full disclosure, I've only seen the fourth season or series, and I've seen a couple of the specials. To me, the show is interesting because it's kind of like the Borgias and the Tudors meets, like, I don't know, the chattering class 21st century version of what is basically feudalism. You know,
wait, do you mean
like,
the actual Borgias and Tudors? Or I mean the television show, the Borgias and the Tudors.
I haven't seen the television shows, but I'm assuming both.
Okay,
Yeah, I'm assuming both will apply there. But it's this whole show is basically about, you know, this cloak and dagger conspiracy that kind of unfolds in every season and, you know, kind of the machinations of the unelected experts, quote unquote, that try to maneuver people into power that who will give them advantage. And really, they're the real government, and the elected officials are simply the PR people.
They're the just figureheads that are put forth and run by these behind-the-scenes PR machination-type people.
Get back to the West Wing comparison, this is, like the what you get from this show, like... first of all, I've always despised the West Wing. I've never been able to watch that show.
Can we just shit on the West Wing for a little while?
But okay, I just want to make the comparison of, like, in that show, and I think it's very characteristically American in a lot of ways, is how we are kind of a sucker for idealism in this country, with, in our political system, no real-world evidence to back that idealism up about politicians. But in the thick of it, it's the opposite. Nobody has pure motives, and nobody has clean hands. And the politicians, except in very rare instances, never talk about what the people want. And they have contempt for the citizens they're supposed to be representing when they think about them at all.
Yeah. The politicians are especially notable for that. It's interesting to me the way that the politicians are ostensibly the rulers, but they have complete and utter contempt for the population. And then the PR people who actually have any power, Malcolm and Jamie and those sorts, always treat actual citizens with some degree of respect. And like Malcolm and Jamie, especially in the like in the special, completely just boss around and push around the politicians and shout at them and treat them like total shit. But, you know, when Jamie bumps into that one cleaning lady, he's just like, oh, terribly, terribly sorry. I'm so sorry.
Yeah, because they view politics as this game. Everybody who's playing the game is fair, you know, for whatever attack. And everybody on the outside is a civilian. You know, they're not part of the game and they're not, you know, a target, I guess.
Right. They're just chattel. Basically that they're trying to court in like a really specific way, but beyond that they don't want them to do anything, they, you know. And
well, they're also not a source of power for them, really, like
they just it's like they don't need to bother with them in one respect, but they're also not like lining up headshots or anything. Like Malcolm in the season 4 special, in the inquiry, even says and I think he's actually being quite truthful about this, and you can tell this from his character over time, how he's never going to go after a civilian, you know? They're not part of the war.
Yeah.
Hold on real quick. Do you want to describe what the inquiry is that you're talking about in season 4, if you
can't?
I mean, you don't have to give, like, a shit ton of background, but...
Well, let's see, well, what... I mean, Nicola Murray starts the inquiry, and we can edit this out.
It's an inquiry over leaking, in the culture of leaking in government. Mm-hmm. Okay, that's it. That's basically all we need to describe. Because that's a running theme throughout the show, which is how you... Information is currency in government and in your relationship with the press, and who... Being in the loop means having power. Being out of the loop means being out of power. Yeah. So,
And we're kind of jumping all over the place here, so I apologize for not having a sort of coherent approach to this series, but there's so much to talk about in this series. And one of the important things is just how ineffectual... the media is, and they don't really do any reporting. They just sort of sit and wait to be told what the news is. That's one of the major, I think, points of the show. In the very first episode, the very first scene of the series, Malcolm explains how he tells the press what to say, because otherwise, if they don't say what he wants them to say, he won't tell them what to say later, and they won't have the news at any point. He completely controls access to any information, and therefore can have the media kowtow to whatever he wants them to do.
That's true, but the media is also sensationalist, and in that, sometimes they keep him honest. Like, in the fourth season, they, you know, photograph a citizen's private information that was recorded on somebody's notebook, and then that's what kicks off the inquiry into leaking. So in that instance, media kind of did its job.
Yeah, yeah, but kind of as a total fluke, and that was not really what they were intending to do.
It didn't exactly kick off the inquiry.
Yeah, the media does not have pure motivations. The media people hate Malcolm Tucker, which is something you learn over the course of the four seasons, just because the run of the show, it's just he's so brutal to them that they're happy to crucify him by the end of
right.
it. But it's a total hypocrisy on their part, because they're completely complicit with this system.
Yeah, it's almost, the show is as cynical about the media as it is about government, perhaps even more so, actually.
Well, I think there's also levels to the media. Like, you're describing, like, certain outlets of the media that are kind of like the media establishment, but there is, like, the tabloids and sort of, like, the shopping center rags.
Yeah,
kind
there's
of...
those. There's also the blogosphere. The show does take on the blogosphere at certain moments as this sort of new media force that's not well understood by those in power. A lot of season three circles around, like, there's an episode about Twitter leaks.
Yeah.
And
That's a really interesting episode. They're trying to... This woman is starting some campaign trying to get behind some campaign of regulations because her husband died in a... You're talking about that episode,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Where the coffee house collapsed and killed her husband. And so they're kind of, like, using her as a political tool. And then they're like, there's this leak that's going on, and they're trying to figure out who it is. Turns out, like, it's her, and she's just because she has a Twitter account.
And she's just describing what she's seeing. Too.
Exactly,
she's
yeah.
Right.
And it hadn't occurred to the... And somebody's trying to explain it to Nicola, I think.
Yeah. Ollie is saying, and she's like, what's Twitter? And Ollie is just like, oh, it's this thing where you just type out this message, and anybody anywhere in the world can read it immediately, and it just goes out to millions of people right away. And this has totally escaped the notice of these media gatekeepers within the administration, that there's this new communications technology that is completely undermining their power and authority.
Yeah,
it's interesting. I mean, that's an interesting take on the culture of spin, because that is, and there are these completely uncontrollable aspects to the media now. There's no way to keep a lid on Twitter. I mean, Malcolm can, like, threaten to, you know, destroy somebody, but it's not going to matter
once it's out there.
Yeah, exactly.
I just wanted to say to you, by way of introductory remarks, that I'm extremely miffed about today's events, and in my quest to try and make you understand the level of my unhappiness, I'm likely to use an awful lot of what we would call violent sexual imagery. And I just wanted to check that neither of you would be terribly offended by that.
I could actually do without the theatrics, I think, Malcolm.
Enough. E-fucking enough. You need to learn to shut your fucking cave, right? Fucking dead as well, that fucking texting coward. Give me his number. What's his fucking number? Give me the fucking number of Tim and Ryslip. If you don't give me his fucking number, do you know what I'm gonna have to do? I'm gonna have to fucking go to fucking Ryslip and fucking snap the thumb and forefinger off of every single person I see who I think resembles the kind of wanker that'll be walking around in this day and fucking age with a name like fucking Tim. How do you think that sounds, huh?
Quite mad.
Raising it ourselves.
Hmm? You actually want the opposition to do this? We are through the looking glass now, folks. Fuck me. Oh, is it going to have any... Come the fuck in or fuck the fuck off.
Well, I'll come the fuck in then.
No, what does that mean for me, then?
I guess that means that you're
standing in the chamber of the House of Commons with your big flaccid dick hanging out with a Vote For Me sticker on the end.
But you said I had a chance about half an hour ago. You said I was in with a shot.
Don't fucking get... Look, half an hour ago you were in with a shot. This is half an hour hence. We're fucking time travelled, yes? We're in a weird and wonderful world where everything is different. Maybe outside, the polar ice caps have melted. Maybe there's fucking robots knocking about and Davina McCall's a new pope. Maybe you can download rice. I want you right now to think about your future, okay? Think about what you are doing. Get yourself back on the train to fucking Thomasville. Pronto, yeah? Half an hour.
I think I could write that one up myself. No. I think I could do the punctuation on that one.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Okay, I was patronizing.
Hey. Hi, Angela. Oh, I like the hair. It's a nice little corkscrew. How's it going?
Yeah, fine. We were just talking about why Angela shouldn't do a big story on the big insidery piece kind of day of spin sort of spread in the paper.
I don't know. Maybe you should. Good idea. Oh, wait a minute. I know why she shouldn't. Because, you know, if she did that, she'd be dead to me, to this department, to the government. And she'd never get another story. Or a fucking whiff of a story. So long as she kept her sorry hack bitch face lingering around Westminster. Because I would call every editor I know, which obviously that's all of them. And I'd tell them to gouge her name out of their address books so she'd never even get a job on hospital radio where the sad sack belongs. That's what I'd tell her. But maybe you should do it. See you later.
Yeah. He can be really nice. And we're this party and they're this party and therefore how can I influence that?
You take this and this and you put it onto your bird's breasts and you rub them and squeeze them very, very gently.
Yeah.
You get her into the sack, you bang her fucking brains out, you make sure that she comes and you just give her the policy.
Yeah, but...
Go and make a contribution to fucking Amnesty International. Go and buy a goat that whole village can fuck. But you are doing this for me.
Malcolm... You're bullying me, and, you know, I don't know why you're bullying me.
How dare you?
You are...
How dare you? Don't you ever, ever call me a bully. I'm so much worse than that. Do it, okay? Wash your hands.
Early in season one, there's a point in which, you know, Hugh has been assaulted in the papers by some journalist...
Hugh Abbott, an MP.
One of the MPs early in the show's run. And so they decide as a sort of fuck you to get back at them to launch some new policy. But they come up with two mutually opposite, completely opposed, ideologically at odds policies, and they float sort of both of them, saying, well, they could both play. Which one do you think we should do? Because they, you know... These politicians have no ideas. They don't care.
Right.
It doesn't mean anything. They're not ideologically based. They're just, they need a policy to get out there so they look good. Mm-hmm. And in fact, that's a sort of running theme throughout the entirety of the show, is that you can't really tell the difference between the policies of the conservative and the liberal parties in this show. That it makes almost no difference who's in power.
All the policies are really, really shitty.
They're really shitty, and the politicians are so inept that they always just get shit on and shut down and end up being nothing at all anyways.
Yeah, or even when they do become something, it doesn't matter. It's not actually a policy for the people and to, like, make people's lives better. It's just a defense strategy. Every policy is just a strategy, and they bail out on it immediately.
The very first episode in the show is about Hugh Abbott announcing this policy and then being told by Malcolm he can't announce that policy, so he has to go announce nothing.
Well, he didn't get permission from the Prime Minister.
Right, right.
The Prime Minister, he was like,
you should
having
do
lunch.
This.
Yeah, he's like, this is the sort of thing we should be doing. And he took that as a go ahead to
be
do
doing.
It. Yeah.
So he,
should.
So he lines up this press conference and he has to go to it and announce effectively nothing at this press conference because he can't launch the policy. And then the PM accidentally backs this policy elsewhere to another reporter, so he has to make sure the press know that he did in fact announce this policy at this press conference that they were at, where he explicitly did not announce the policy. And that's when Malcolm has his little speech where he says, you know, they know you didn't say it, but they're going to say that you said it because I'm going to tell them that you said it.
There's a story that I read about FDR that during like the height of the Great Depression, where he was in a meeting with advisors, these economic advisors, telling him exact opposite things about what should be done. I forget what it was. One is like raise taxes, the other's lower taxes or something like that. And he, you know, talking to a speechwriter and just go ahead and write it up. He's like, well, which one should I write up, which policy recommendation? He was like, just stitch them together, you know, something like that. Just like, let's do both of them. So,
well, yeah, that's what this show is about. Is about how politics is not a moral playing field. It's like a game.
Yeah,
and it's basically all about.
It's not moral. It's not ideological. These aren't idealistic people trying to get into power to do good in the world, which is why it's the anti-West Wing, because
right.
Every politician in that show, every person in power really cares about trying to do good. It's just all the bullshit that the media throws at them
right.
That they have to deal with.
Well, and they may be compromised because of the nature of the political game, because of, you know, and it's interesting you say it's not ideological, because a lot of times our view is that, well, all the compromises come from the fact that, you know, left and right can't set aside differences to work together because they're so ideologically focused on their conservatism or their liberalism, and so you get this idea that as well, it's the far left that is keeping the Democrats, you know, or the far right. Nobody wants to compromise, but in fact, as you mentioned before, you really, especially if you're not familiar with British politics, as none of us are really, cannot tell the difference between the Liberal Party and the Conservative Party. What sets them apart is the Conservative Party has out-of-date clothes and cultural references.
Yeah.
That is how you identify the Conservative Party. They look like they're from the 80s. So,
yeah. But it's interesting what you were talking about, how the media just reports what they've been told to report, and they don't report like what actually happened, because what actually happened doesn't even matter. Everything's semantics in this show. Everything is like, reality is determined by the consensus that's formed, you know, in these rooms where they just kind of like eviscerate each other and tear each other apart. But it doesn't even nearly resemble what actual reality is, which you don't even get an idea of like what Britain is actually like from this show. You don't have any idea about like what policy challenges British government even confronts. Mm-hmm. None of those things even come into play on the show. It's like totally absent from.
Yeah, anytime that. Any policy, anything that you would expect government would be about, anytime it comes up, it's shoved into the corner and given no importance whatsoever.
Right.
You know, people like Robin, these, what are they?
Civil servants.
They're the ones who are actually responsible for keeping the government running, while the elected officials go about trying to fuck each other over and backstab and finagle more power.
Yeah, it's just basically they're looking ahead to the next election cycle, and I mean, that's the most important thing. I mean, what this show is about, it's about the cult of experts, you know, using semantics and using, I don't know, psychology to put forth an agenda that they themselves are not even aware of. And that agenda is constantly changing over time. I mean, there's a scene where we just watched on one of the specials where the guy says, "Well, half an hour ago you said that I was going to be the next candidate for the party," and he just gets ripped apart by Malcolm, who says, like, half an hour ago? This is half an hour hence. Are you crazy? You know,
we're walking in some weird future and robots are knocking about outside.
Right, right. And this,
maybe
like
the pole rice caps have melted. Maybe you can download rice.
But yeah, exactly. And that's their conception of time. Like, past doesn't matter. Really, future doesn't even matter. It's just kind of like, who is in the snake pit at the moment, and then which one of the dogs is attacking the bear in the bear baiting ring most effectively?
Well, if it's all spin, reality is revisable at any moment.
Yeah,
so.
And reality is just determined by the experts. It's a cult of experts. And I am reading Tragedy and Hope by Carol Quigley. Really great book. It's like a really great history book, but it's kind of like
conspiracy fans will probably be familiar with this book.
Conspiracy researchers hear this name.
Maybe you
want to
give some
book.
Background of that.
Yeah, yeah. Conspiracy researchers are kind of a fan of this book. It's not a conspiracy theory book. I mean, I should be clear about that. It's a work of interpretive history from a military political historian. And it is interesting, but there's only like a small portion of the book that conspiracy researchers are really interested in. And that is the, I guess, the secret machinations of these nonprofit foundations and something called the Royal Institute in England. Anyway, it's a long story. Great book. History is a long story, though, so you should. But you should definitely check it out. But he also does a little Dr. Quigley does a lot of, you know, prognosticating about the future. This book is written in the 1960s, and he says he makes a prediction about kind of the course of 20th century politics and into the 21st century that I thought was really prescient here, and what the show is about. He says here on page 866, regardless of the outcome of the situation, it is increasingly clear that in the 20th century, the expert will replace the industrial tycoon in control of the economic system, even as he will replace the democratic voter in control of the political system. This is because planning will inevitably replace laissez-faire in the relationships between the two systems. And then he goes on, but in general, his freedom of choice, that is the citizen's freedom of choice, will be controlled within a very narrow alternatives by the fact that he will be numbered from birth and followed as a number through his educational training, his required military or other public service, his tax contributions, his health and medical requirements, and his final retirement and death benefits. And that's what this show is about. It's about the secret priesthood of experts that will control everything, but what the comedy of the show hinges upon their total inability to control anything, or
yeah.
even themselves for
yeah,
a
yeah.
matter of time.
Sorry to keep going back to like the West Wing comparison, but it just is so apt to me. In the West Wing, people the people with the expertise are omni-capable and have an arsenal of facts at their command at every particular moment, and speak in just unrealistically witty witticisms constantly. They're just hyper on it, which in reality, if you're a person who is at that level of capability, the like fantasy of the Ivy League brain trust, you're probably a psychopath. You're probably a complete and utter sociopath.
Right.
In this show, the experts are, and I'm thinking of people who are like the like big policy brain guru guys, and for the Liberal Party, it's Julius Nicholson.
Uh-huh.
And for the Conservative Party, it's Stuart Pearson. To
the
use the
transceiver.
Yeah, yeah. They're basically like head in the clouds, to use the British preferred term, twats. That's what they are, and their ideas bear very little relation to reality.
They're so experimental and out there that they're completely and utterly useless. Stuart Pearson pitches such brilliant ideas as, let's get rid of computers. Or why don't we have the completely digital society? Why don't we have digital buses and digital hospitals?
Yeah. Digital buses. What the f*** is a digital bus?
Yeah.
Digital also, frisbees. The other thing with the experts, there's an episode in series two where Malcolm is trying to convince Hugh to say that he's for integrating these special schools back into the regular schools. And Hugh's talking about this expert he's talking to who's telling him that's a bad idea. And Malcolm says, well, I've got an expert that's going to say the exact opposite of what your expert says.
Right.
And Hugh says, well, who is that? And Malcolm says, oh, I don't know. I'll find him when I need him.
You know that you can find an expert to say what you want.
Yeah,
fallacy
that's embraced by something like the West Wing is that we have a system that produces the best and brightest, and the best and brightest are then chosen out of a group of best and brightest to become...
The breast and
rightest. To become the members of government, but... That's just not true. I mean, the people that are on the thick of it, they probably grew up in sort of like a prep school environment where they were constantly jockeying for the teacher's attention, or, you know, trying to get a good grade by basically using some sort of political system rather than a meritocracy, you know. And that's the situation that they get raised in, and then when they get to the level of government, it's just a viper's nest because it's full of those people. And that's what democracy promotes, is this kind of sociopath rising up into the ranks. It requires a savage aggressiveness that's completely inhuman.
Which, ironically, like, probably Malcolm is one of the few, just speculating, but probably did not, like, he probably does not have the education that a lot of the other politicos do.
Yeah,
he got out of his ruthlessness.
No, but why do you say that, Ray? Like, why do
you kind of get that? You get the sense over the course of the show that Malcolm is not the Poxbridge, Oxford sort of born to rule sort of people that he's dealing with around him, and he actually gets quite a kick out of abusing them in his role.
Yeah, he's
power.
Kind of constantly. He likes to take those sorts of people down a peg or two. Like when he tells the journalist, I'm going to eviscerate you. I don't know what that means. I don't have your education, but I'm going to start by ripping your cock off. So I do get that feeling that Malcolm has kind of an axe to grind against those people.
Yeah.
And also he's not as in a bubble vis-a-vis ordinary people as a lot of those other people are. For instance, the episode we just watched with Ben Swain abusing the cleaning woman, just out of being, you know, tired, it's late in the night, and she's like, can you get out of the way so I can clean? And Ben Swain freaks out on this woman, and you can see Malcolm, like, his face, like, oh shit, this is going to be a thing, and he talks to the woman after that to keep her from going to the press.
But it also kind of points up that even if this is a meritocracy, which it very well, I guess, could be...
No, it isn't. I'm not saying just because Malcolm is where he is that... probably from a different background, that it's a meritocracy. I'm saying what his skills got, the skills that he relies on to get him there are pure viciousness.
No, of course. And that's the point I'm trying to make, is that even if you did want to transit into the chattering class, into the political class, you basically have to be even more savage than the people that have, you know, been born and bred to become those people. So even if it was a meritocracy, even if everybody had access to the political class, the only people that would survive would be people that just have a total sociopathological neurosis, you know?
Yeah, well, as Malcolm says in the final episode, he had to eat this life and let it fester in him and become this shell of a man that he is now. Very, very good at his job, very committed to it, but that's all he is.
Great
scene.
Like he's possessed by his
job. Great
scene,
but it just shows, like, how totally unhappy Malcolm is. And,
yeah,
like,
oh, of course.
And he's just saying really what probably every one of those people think in their private moments, is that they don't like the kind of person that they've become, that they cannot reinvent themselves. They've been programmed, either through education or their environment or whatever, into being total vipers.
Well, you can see by the end of the show when he's—I don't know if I should spoil it—but Malcolm goes down in not in a spectacular way, in an inevitable way. Let's just say he's kind of undone by the system that he gamed for a long time, and you could just see it on his face that he knows he's leaving no legacy. He has no friends. He has really nothing to hang his hat on at the end of this, other than, you know, probably some fucking ulcers and some other horrible shit that's
premature aging.
Yeah.
Goodbye and thanks for all the varicose veins.
Yeah, exactly.
Secretaries feel better when they put those stamps on all those letters. We gotta rock and non-stop tonight, at the government center. Make the secretaries feel better when they put the stamps on the ledges. Won't stop until we see secretaries smile. We gotta see some office boys there jumping for joy. Tell old Mr. Ahern, calm down a while. You know, that's the only way the center is ever gonna get better. So, think I could feel better. All look out. We're gonna help them out. Take all our equipment. Do rock and roll. That's right. Who's that feeling we have inside? We're gonna transmit. The secretaries will have to stand up and not feel sick. Oh, it's gonna be fun. Oh, we won't get scared if we get kicked out. Oh, that feeling inside. We're gonna transmit it to life, baby.
I want to take this occasion to point a bit of trivia out about the show. In season three, when Peter Capaldi is looking especially haggard, Peter Capaldi being the actor who portrays Malcolm Tucker, because it's the end of the conservative administration and everything, the ship is completely sinking. The writers on the show were actually giving Peter Capaldi lines the day before taping, and then rewriting all of his lines that night and requiring him to memorize a new set of lines each day of shooting.
There's so much authenticity on this show. I mean, like, the acting is just incredible. I mean, you have, you have, like, the brilliant writing, first of all. It's just sort of, like, this semantic fuck pit. I don't have any other words for it.
Yeah, well, and the writers were very expressly attacking things that they knew the actors were sort of sensitive about. Them.
Really?
They were using what they knew about the real actors to construct these insults for them. So every time you see these looks of complete sort of dejectedness on the show, there's a little bit of, reality coming across.
Oh my God. In the way that politics has to interact with the world in general, everybody has to be super sensitive and watch what they say to avoid offending anybody till it becomes this bland fucking porridge. But with each other, it's all about, like, the wittiest thing to cut down the other person constantly.
Yeah. Yeah.
Constant one-upsmanship, showing that you're smarter, showing that you're more clever, you know. And it's really, like, politics is Hobbes's war of all against all, constantly. Uh-huh. Nobody has friends. Nobody likes each other. It is impossible. If you forge a friendship, that's weakness. It will be destroyed. It will be exploited. There's just no way of forging long-term bonds.
Scruples?
Yeah.
What are they? Are those light kettle chips?
It's like with Glenn and Ollie. Glenn and Ollie are the main advisors for the MP of DOSAC, and I forget what it was called before. I think just SAC.
DOSAC.
Before season three when they changed the name.
Yeah,
it was the Department of Social
DOSA.
Department of Sawdall, Department of Stuffed Anuses.
Like, there are several moments throughout the all four seasons where they both just say to each other, like, I'm done with you. Like, I can't take you anymore. Glenn more often, we're just like, you're not even a real human being. I can't stand this anymore. But they're the closest things to colleagues and what should be like decent friends because they've been working for a while.
Well, Glenn,
they can't do it. Like,
they're completely insipid people. There's that one scene where Hugh Abbott is looking like he's going to have to resign, and Ollie and Glenn are outside having a smoke, and they're sort of talking about, oh, well, you know, one of us should really step up and bite the bullet for Hugh on this one, and you know, I should resign for this, and they both say that they should resign, and then they both point out that, you probably should resign.
Yeah, sure. Well, fuck you, man, I'm not going anywhere.
Like, no way, I'm not resigning. I'm definitely not resigning over this.
Yeah, fuck you, I'm not resigning. You resign. And it's like kind of like this ballet of just verbal judo. It's the triumph of quantity over quality. I mean, that's what the whole show is about. Is that quality cannot be discovered. It cannot be found anywhere within these people, within their policies. It's just the amount of savagery that they have. They have to keep heaping on more and more and more in order to expect to keep their jobs. And it's like the competition is not just like how much you can dish out, but how much you can take. Like, if I was any of these people, I'd be, like, sobbing in the bathroom. But, like, none of them allow themselves that weakness, you know?
Well, to talk about Glenn, he's an interesting character because he does have these breakdowns where he says, look, I'm a human being, I'm a man, you know? And I don't know whether it's possibly he's a relic from a time when it wasn't that bad, or he's getting older. He's starting to think about life in some way and being like, what have I devoted my life to? You know, I need recognition as a human being. And here's the thing. If this was another show, this was an American show, his breakdown, his I'm a man breakdown would be followed by some recognition by other characters. Like, okay, yes, we will.
Redeemer.
In this show, nope. There's condescension or outright derision.
Yeah, there's a small amount of sympathy from Malcolm Tucker on that part, which is interesting because that special, that breakdown, happens right before the start of season three, and a major theme of season three is Malcolm hitting 50 and starting to lose his sort of touch at his job.
His edge,
And that's when he starts saying that, I'm going to have no legacy, this job is done nothing for me.
He has
me,
no
really.
Children.
Yeah.
He has no. He's not married. He doesn't have like any personal life at all. Like the job, whatever it is, is his whole life.
Even when he takes a holiday, he invites prominent editors and writers from maybe the Independent or something like one of the major news outlets over for lunch at his place.
Really?
Tells everybody that he was in Spain or Barbados or some shit.
He's doing politics,
but he's doing
politics
on
time.
He effectively takes no holidays.
Yeah.
This is how he becomes who he is, because he doesn't take holidays. He has to take his holidays while working by getting his pleasure by abusing people. He takes his fun where he can get it, basically, which is, you know, he has to enjoy the cruelty, basically. Fucking with people and
You know, recently Barack Obama was on vacation in Hawaii, and I read that he like didn't spend any time with his family. He just like spent all this time golfing basically by himself. You know, what kind of a person does something like that? That is Barack Obama
a deeply depressed individual?
No, somebody that like just can't take like who he is and the situation that he's in, and he just needs to like be himself for like a moment just to sort of decompress, and like not even being around his family can help detoxify him and help him like,
and golfing is more fun than crying in a cold shower.
Have you ever noticed how much Barack Obama talks about his kids too? Like he's totally overcompensating for like not hanging out with them, and
I don't actually listen to what he says, so
I don't know.
Yeah, exactly. I don't.
He like pretends to be this overprotective father with like his teenage girls and stuff. He's like, oh, I'm gonna send the Secret Service to kill their boyfriends, all this other stuff. And it's like, well, wait, so you need armed guards to like, you know, to like be abreast of what your child's dating life is really like?
What must being a fucking kid of a politician at that level be like? What chance do you have of growing up normal? This is a good time as any to bring up something that I had made a note of and I wanted to ask everybody about. Like, we've been dumping on politicians, and I fucking hate politicians, but like the show brings out a lot of sympathy in me for the life of a small level politician with not a very much power, and they have no life. They're not allowed, because everything is fair game. Your personal life is fair game. Mm-hmm. It's used to. I mean, none of these politicians can have normal, regular person lives. They're owned by the state.
Mm-hmm. Kind of the downfall of Hugh Abbott, it centers around this second flat that he owns in the city, so that he can actually go sleep at some point, because it's like a 4-hour drive to his home, and he's just like, he's either at work or in transit to work. He goes home, there's like an episode where he gets home and then gets a call that he has to like go back to work like right away.
Like, is that okay? Did I wake you? He's like, no, I haven't even gone to sleep or taken my trousers off.
And then season three, Nicola Murray comes in, and she, at the start of that season, is just a normal sort of person. She's still got her private life, and as soon as she's an MP, a minister in the cabinet, that all goes out the window. Malcolm has complete control over her life, dictating, you know, what her husband does and whether her daughter goes to a private school or not.
Yeah, they make her put her daughter in a shitty public school. Actually,
where she's already failed at before.
Isn't that like reversed?
I think
it's
called
public
a private
over there.
School.
Yeah, I think it's actually
like
called a
comprehensive. I don't know.
Comprehensive, because you can't. You're saying that the government schools are shitty by doing that, and they are shitty, but you can't say
knife adult rape shit.
Yeah. Yeah. And it turns out to be a disaster. It also comes up that she has claustrophobia. She can't take elevators, and that's going to be a political tool, even though a phobia is a totally. It's not common, but it's totally normal. It doesn't indicate that you're a psychopath or can't do your job.
If a normal person said, "Oh, I have claustrophobia. I'm going to take the stairs," a normal person wouldn't bat an eye at that. But that's ammunition for a journalist, and it's something to be defensive about for a PR.
Well, and then
like Malcolm Tucker.
Yeah, and then I'm reminded too of when Peter Mannion in season 4, he like goes to visit his wife on his anniversary to have lunch with her.
Yeah,
and it's like a big problem. Was that champagne?
During the workday?
Is that champagne during the workday? And he's like,
bottle.
It's a half bottle.
What are you, P. Diddy?
Right. It's a half bottle of champagne, and I'm putting it in the recycling bin. He has to kind of like point out that he's putting it in the recycling bin. I mean,
back to Nicola Murray, though, I wanted to say, like, I love how they introduce her, because she comes in this bright, flowery dress, and she is just like, time to change things around. It's Murray time. And then Malcolm comes in and
set the phasers to equality.
Destroys her and turns her into Glummy Mummy, and she comes out in just all black, and she's sad all the time.
By the way, you have no money or power, and the press is going to be throwing darts made of human shit right at your face every day.
Yeah, she's immediately disabused of any notion of doing any good.
And he even says that you are now bought and paid for by the state. And you have as registered by the little barcode under your armpit.
And by the fourth season, Nicola never, even by the end of that season, she never talks about anything idealistic anymore at all. It's just, it's now just careerism and hanging on, you know?
I really feel bad for Nicola Murray, and then I feel bad also for the other women on this show, too. Like,
yeah.
It just seems to be this masculine knife fight, basically, all the time.
Oh,
and
That's women when they try to... I wanted to introduce that because there's a point where she's confronting Malcolm, or he's confronting her, and she's just like, this is what is ruining politics, the male obsession with conflict.
Right.
And what do you guys think about that? I mean, is that the case, or is it at least in the world of the show?
I think so in the show. I mean, you look at all the women in the show, and they're either useless, completely useless, like the civil servants Robin and Terry, or they're like Nicola, where they're just defeated and used as a pawn anyway. Or in Peter Mannion's advisor, I forgot her name, the blonde girl that Ollie hooked up with for a little bit. Anyway, she acts just like the men. Like, she's not really a woman in that show. She's just another man.
Well, I mean, there are female figures of power in that show, and they're just... So I'm not entirely sure I agree with that point necessarily, because, I mean, in the show, immediately Malcolm just calls her out on that as just total psycho fanny bullshit. Mm-hmm. And there is something to that, because there are plenty of savvy, conniving female politicians in the show. People like Claire Ballantyne are clearly in positions of power.
She's not that conniving or savvy, though.
You don't get to see her that much in the show, but you have to assume that she's probably doing okay in politics as she leads these commissions and stuff like that. And there's not a great deal of powerful female characters. But the female characters that are there, the politicians, are just as easily... we talked about feeling bad for Nicola Murray, but she is easily seduced by Malcolm Tucker into wanting just power.
Right.
Malcolm asks her if she's hungry for this, and she says she is. I mean, she's so incompetent that she just can't pull it off.
Right.
But if she could, she would be Dan Miller. She would be just as slimy
absolutely.
And snaky as he is.
Yeah.
I don't think it's necessarily a strong point of the show to say this is a man's game. I think they do put that in there a little bit, but... No matter what trumps that is that it's the system that turns you into this.
Well, it's kind of inevitable that when it's all based around, like, cutting other people down and, like, being witty in that way, we know that, like, the way the culture is, that women aren't, like, are sort of trained to not do that because they're supposed to be nicer than we are, you know?
Yeah.
So they're not as skilled in that game when they, by the time they get into that position.
Equipped.
Yeah.
Well, I think... I don't know that it's like a, you know, like a male phenomenon, but of course politics can't function when it's like pathologically attached to conflict in the way that it is on the show. I'm going to bring up Tragedy and Hope just one more time, and that's it.
Sure, but no problem.
He talks about Tsarist Russia in one of the earlier chapters, and how, like, late Tsarist Russia was just a complete basket case. The government didn't work at all, pretty much because everybody was a double agent of some kind. So everybody had, like, their professed political allegiance, but then they also had, like, a secret political allegiance, and everything was, like, these backroom sort of deals. It was basically a whole class of people that behaved exactly like they do on the show. Mm-hmm. And nothing worked. Nobody had, like, any real policies because nobody anymore had any real ideas. It was just sort of like, what is the political flavor of the day? I am that, you know. And then,
and being an imperial bureaucracy, they were probably massively disconnected from reality.
Well, and then they were also just saddled. They had, you know, this massive bureaucracy that was saddled to this, like, addled empire, you know, full of inbred, ineffectual elites, basically, which I think The Thick of It could do a better job of showing the peer system as being like that. There's kind of like, they kind of show the British peers as being redemptive, and that they actually serve a real function, and that they're not like,
they don't have a huge role in the show. Yeah, kind of right. that one special in the fourth season where they have the inquiry is kind of the only time you come in contact with the British lords in this series.
Yeah.
But you're also kind of show that they have, I mean, Malcolm totally attacks them and calls them out on that, that they're just as bad as any of the rest of them. They're part of the system, and they never tell you what's going on there, but there's something going on with Baron Sirica, and Malcolm is sort of like leaking her dirty laundry, airing that out there, just showing, see, you're as corrupt as the rest of us.
I totally didn't even notice until the last time rewatching it that she was a baroness, and I was that there was something being said about that, or like why she's on that board, how she got into that position. Yeah.
Everybody in that room in the inquiry got there by doing the dirty deeds that, yeah.
Well, the other thing
on the show in full.
Yeah, the other thing you have to consider too is that there's maybe some redeeming features to the peer system, and we were kind of talking about it before the show, but Hans Hermann Hoppe famously said that monarchy is preferable to democracy, because with democracy, and I'm paraphrasing here, the shitbirds always rise to the top, whereas with monarchy, you might actually...
That's not a Hoppe phrase, shitbirds. I was pretty sure that was a Hoppe coinage.
Right. But with monarchy, you might actually luck into somebody that actually gives a shit and wants to do a good job, and... you know, it'd be nice if we had something like that here in the United States. I'm not a monarchist or anything, or even an archist. An archist, yeah.
I'm an archist, but there is something to, you know, have you seen Game of Thrones, to bring up something totally unrelated to this, but
yeah,
I'll tie it in. There's the eunuch character on that show says that he has to be responsible for the city because the rulers are too busy struggling for power. And so there, I think there's some sort of merit to people who have the concern, hopefully, of the benefit of the land or the citizenry. And elected officials don't have the time scale,
right,
capable of long-term stewardship of anything like a country or a people.
Yeah.
They have a time horizon of about 4 years or whatever the election
cycle
is. You come in, you shit out all your policy ideas into a giant fan and let it spread before you have to wipe and leave.
Well, Quigley talks about that too in the lead up to World War One. Was that, like, that's one of the reasons why World War One happened, was because democracy had kind of, like, that meme had kind of spread throughout Western Europe, and now, instead of having, like, monarchs who, you know, could, like, look ahead for basically the entirety of their lives, now you had elected officials that are really only thinking in short-term ways and forming their alliances as such.
And Hoppe talks a lot about the way that monarchs wage warfare, which is that they're interested in limiting civilian casualties, limiting damage to the land, because after the war is over, they're going to have to pay to fix all this shit.
Yeah.
They're really only interested in their strategic win, otherwise the war isn't worth it to him, whereas a politician can wage a war for to score political points.
Yeah.
They don't have to think about what happens in 10 years when this war is over, because who knows, they're not, probably not even going to be in office anymore.
Well, and it's important for them, too, to, like, beat their chests and to have this sort of, like, posturing that's basically irrational just to appeal to the voter.
It's interesting. Most of the, like, political issues in the series, the thick of it, are kind of small beer, you know? But they don't really get into big stuff until you see the movie In the Loop, which is a sort of spin-off of this show, I guess. And that is dealing with the Iraq War. I don't know if we want to get into that at all.
I haven't seen it, so no.
Okay.
it's a whole other kind of tangent to what the thick of it is.
It
about.
Is, yeah. But anyways, it's a good movie. I recommend everybody seeing it.
It's definitely highly recommended.
Yeah. It's on Netflix, right, Ray?
Yeah.
It should be. I wanted
Did you just get Ray $20 or something?
Netflix,
right. You said it
Netflix
was.
Just gave Ray 20
bucks. I heard Netflix and Hulu have all these things.
Use the code Anarchy and Culture.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wanted to sort of backtrack a few moments to something we were talking about earlier, where in Spinners and Losers, the special we just watched, where you have this moment where, like, Glenn and Nicholson kind of connect on this level where they're both feeling left out of the loop and just old, and they're just sitting there listening to the cricket and eating biscuits, and it's sort of this endearing moment where
very they, English
a
moment
very, well,
as well
it's, a very, it's a very human moment yeah. is what it is yeah. but Glenn, in his eagerness to hang on to politics and stay in the game, is so excited to have some information to share to somebody that he immediately runs to Jamie and rats out Nicholson for leaking this information, which, you know, results in Jamie completely flipping out and having this over-the-top reaction.
Eat the fucking cheese!
Eat
the
cheese,
Nicholson!
Eat that prawn!
You're like throwing food at him.
Yeah, and then it just turns into this adolescent food fight.
But I just noticed that in this last viewing was just the way that Glenn is just so thrilled to have some information to share with somebody, because, again, cutting people down and having information, that's currency in this world. What you're, that's how you are valued, is how in the loop and in the thick of it you are.
You climb the ladder by making a pile of corpses to run up.
Well, and it's like, to what purpose? Like, nobody stops to think to what purpose any of this serves. It's like, as long as you are in the scrum, you know, as long as you're kind of like in the center of the struggle, you are somebody. It doesn't matter if you're totally treading water and producing nothing, which is what the political class does. It produces nothing.
Yeah.
So it needs to manufacture a currency for a legitimization function.
Yeah.
And that ultimately is semantics. That's word power.
Wise words from the distinguished elderly gay fucking tennis coach here.
Seriously, I think we should talk about my strategy further, because I really think that's the
yeah,
way.
Yeah, the fucking wee ball boy's having a go now with his wee fucking tight shorts on. All right, hinge and bracket. Time to go and hang up your lady cocks. Oh, hey, Yoko Ono and the two remaining Beatles, piss off.
What does that make me? Ronald McDonald. Well, fuck off.
I could use that sonar, Batty Man.
Right. Forgive me, I think that's Jamaican slang for homosexual.
Yes, I was thinking that as I said it. I'm really sorry. I didn't. No.
Yeah, that's right. Rip your shirt off. Go on, Braveheart. Freedom!
Fuck off, bagpuss.
Mr. Lover.
Fucking noses supposes.
Uncle Bulgaria.
Deep beige.
Private Godfrey.
Oh, hello, the Golden Girls.
Dr. Strangelove.
What's up, boo-boo?
Because you're chief of the nodes, aren't you?
I am chief node.
The node of Node Hall.
Sir Whitewash.
Oh, fucking Nosferatu.
Pontius Pilate with the emphasis on Ponce.
Screaming Lord Crutch.
Oh, what, Mr. Baby New Potato Head? Fuck off.
You put the pitbull in charge all of a sudden.
You know what they're calling already?
No.
Ugly Betty.
I've got a meeting with Leaky Terry. Oh, that sounded wrong.
The Kraken awakes.
Just for a second, Aunt Terry, fuck off.
Right. Sweary woman of Whitehall.
Sweary woman of Whitehall. It's a pun, isn't it? It's not really punning on anything, is it?
Just fucking do it, Holly Golightly. Come on.
Hey, whoa there, turd tonsil.
Lucille Ballbag.
How's the info pump firing?
Well, you mean Terry Coverley? She's useless. She knows nothing. But you two would get on.
Oh, hey. Desperate housewives. Virgin West Coast, shut it!
What about Sue Barker's little sister here?
Joni Mitchell there, it was her.
Oh, male.
Slime face Swift.
That's the one.
Prick Robinson.
bloody siren, arse pipes, titty twat.
Just only being romantic, as I was ordered to by the romance Nazi.
Fucking Rupert Brooke!
Oi, James fucking me.
I'm straight to DVD. I'm the night shift.
Go and read your blog, nerd boy.
Okay, Shitehead Revisited.
You're Mr. Sunshine, are you?
I'm Mr. Sunshine.
You're a little wooden twat.
Me, Aragorn, the true king, you, Boromir. Your horn is broken and will be blown no more.
Are you listening to Daddy?
I wonder what Mr. Political Correctness gone boring once.
Stewpots! The opposition will be getting the fucker in.
Yep. That's what I heard too. They're definitely getting the fucker in.
I haven't heard that.
The fucker, he coming. Oh. No, he coming to your town.
You do know why they call him the fucker, don't you, Terry?
Yes.
Yeah, no, sorry, not you.
Is it because he's a bit of a fucker?
But, like, speaking of the fact that the political class doesn't produce anything, this show actually does make that point in the, is it season four where they're trying to do the apps? I forget what the policy
yeah,
is called.
Yeah,
yeah.
All their policies.
It's
the
Silicon
Playground.
Yeah, yeah, they're basically trying to get free work from college students creating, you know, apps for, I don't know what it is, but, and there's a scene where they actually, like, the student's like, well, why don't I get paid for it? And, like, what do you contribute to this? He's like, well, I'm a minister.
I make you do the things I say.
I'm a minister. I apply technology in scenarios that are efficient.
Right, and I mean, that's the neo-feudalism that Quigley talks about, is that instead of... But in this scenario, it's not like... It's less honest, because the king doesn't just send his thugs out with truncheons to hit you over the head if you don't do the job. You have to be propagandized to. They're constantly trying to convert
you're
you.
You're part of society, you see.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, so does anybody have points they want to make before we... I do have one final question I want to, like,
pitch out there.
Throw out there.
I've got everything that I wanted to say, I think.
Yeah, I think we've got all the things I like about
Yeah, I'm
show.
Just going to throw this question out there, and if everybody's like, I have no idea, that's fine, but is this show, and this is what I mentioned earlier, is this show just a sort of negative satire, or does it leave some impression of what... Is it just saying, here's how shitty the political culture is, or does it leave any room for here's what could be improved, here's what should be done, you know?
Well, I think that mostly no, but there is something kind of in the edges there where every now and then there is a policy that sounds like it might actually be beneficial to somebody, like in season four, the care pass, the carers, which is like this free public transportation for people who have to go to the hospital to take care of family members and
right.
stuff like that. But every time in the show that there's any sort of positive policy even floated whatsoever, it's completely just run roughshod over and just harpooned and destroyed by the machinations of either the press versus the government, or just, you know, this game completely shoots holes in anything that could possibly be a positive. So,
well, and the kids that were going to participate in that program, they're invited to DOSAC, and they are literally ignored.
Yeah,
while they're there,
literally ignored, and they've wasted their day in which they're supposed to be, you know, caring for their family because
yeah.
the care pass isn't launched.
And
or,
all because someone died and they're all really excited about it.
Yeah, or there's this, in season four of the scene where they're talking with the hot economist, and, you know, she's got this plan to set up a bank, but all they really care about is getting laid, and the only reason that they agreed to do the bank is because they're embarrassed and they need to get the woman out of there. So, like, it's not exactly a positive assertion of government, but it is kind of suggesting that, you know, government could be doing good things, it's just really fucking inept.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not even... I agree with what you're saying. I just don't feel like that's really even shed in a positive light at all. I feel like every time there is a decent policy, it's eaten out from the inside, and it's just... I find it to be heavily cynical, and in addition to being satirical, I don't think it does propose many things.
Which is fine with me. I'm
yeah,
perfectly
I'm
okay happy
with
people
too.
Being totally cynical about government. Not about, you know, politics in a larger sense,
mm-hmm.
but about government specifically, absolutely.
I want to float this by you guys. This show is BBC, so it's basically a government-funded show about how much government sucks. I kind of think that it performs the function of limited hangout for the state to basically say, like, yeah, politics is dumb. Oh, everybody hates politics, but it doesn't also... It's significant that it doesn't propose a positive alternative to what's presented there, because it leaves people feeling like there's no hope. Like, you might as well just be a nihilist after watching this show, because there's nothing redeeming about politics. And indeed, I agree. Like, there's nothing redeeming about politics in the way that it's practiced on the show. But I think that there are redeeming alternatives out there. And if this show actually showed a redeeming alternative, it would be a danger to the mechanism that funds it.
Well,
right now it functions as propaganda in the form of limited hangout to say, like, oh, look, here's what's bad about government. Meh. You know, but people don't. People aren't given anything that's solid, anything that's real, because if they did, that would be dangerous.
Well, that's an interesting perspective. I think the genre is also working against that as well, if you consider the artistic form. I mean, it's Swiftian satire, and there's just no room for optimism.
Yeah, I'm not saying there's a strong positive message in there. I am saying it is there, though, because there's the episode about Twitter and how sort of these new media, new bloggers, stuff like that, is undermining the traditional authority. And at the end of the series, when Malcolm is giving his YouTube suicide speech to Ollie is sort of saying, you know, it doesn't have to be like that. Things have changed. We're in a new world with new methods of communication and technology, and you can't be just this complete bully ramrodding your message down the mainstream media anymore, because that's just not what the world is now. It's an understated message, but I actually think it is there.
No, I think it's
there. He does also say that in a way of things are a lot more savvy, and I can take it from here and do the same
Ollie is a snake, but I'm not saying... I think he's specifically saying that Malcolm Tucker's Reign of Terror is outdated.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, if in the political world, information is a kind of currency, the new media is a force of total deflation of that currency, because all the floodgates are open and nobody controls it.
There's no central bank of spin anymore.
Yes.
I like that. I think what we have here is, what flavor of propaganda do you want? Because, like, with the West Wing, that's kind of like the American form, where there's, you know, an idealist bent to it, and it, you know, fulfills the needs of the state. But I would also posit that The Thick of It does the same thing, because it just shows that your involvement in politics, or even trying to understand what politics is about, is futile, because these people have turned it into this nest of semantics that you can't possibly understand, because you're a peasant and you don't have their breeding or their intellect or any of that. And you probably have an alternative. You probably wish that things could be better, but your involvement in that, into turning it into something positive, would just be a mistake.
I'll take that brand of propaganda any day over
it's certainly
one.
It's certainly more entertaining.
It's
more entertaining,
and it's also it has truth in it, which the West Wing lacks.
Right.
Right, but over time, that message can just sort of be diluted down to where your anger isn't as fierce anymore. Like, I mean, the idea that politics is just an omni-shambles, to use a great word from the show, has been a running joke even in our politics and our culture for decades now, of, oh, just the politicians, we should just kill them all because they don't represent us and there's nothing we can do about it. But we continue to let it happen, obviously. So, like, over time, if you just accept that politics and that whole sphere is just fucked and there's nothing you can do about it, then you're not really going to do anything about
it. I don't
know
that we do let it happen to us. It seems like it's just kind of done to us over and over again. I mean, how many people actually vote? How many people are engaged? It's like, you know, it's...
Right, I didn't mean to say you're going to bend over for it, necessarily. And obviously we're not, we're here.
Well,
but...
I'm bent over is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah, you
it's
are
like,
bent
I don't,
over.
I don't have a choice.
I don't know, maybe it's a larger conversation, but I'm not sure I totally buy that as propaganda.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I mean, I can see, not in a conscious way, but there is a way in which comedy serves as a sort of safety valve
Absolutely.
For a system.
Sure, but that seems like just a really, that's not a branding I'm comfortable with, because you can apply that to anything and reasonably justify that as, oh, it's just part of the system, it's just a safety valve, and they're just letting you have your kick. Well, then what is, you know, what is telling the truth then, if not that, if speaking out is just going to let you release pressure, is it better to not have that then? Is it... I don't know. I'm not sure that that's the most useful thing to sort of try to brand something as. It's also not something I'm sure that you can really successfully sell to me.
Right. Yeah, like, I mean, if you want to label this show as statist propaganda, yeah, it doesn't really make sense with what you're seeing in the show, I think, like we just discussed, but, I mean, you could also say that somebody high up gave it their tick or their double stamp just because they saw it as non-threatening.
Yeah, I mean, you could say that it lacks a positive message and therefore is propagandistic, but it's also, you know, that's not the point of the show. Yeah. That's not the point. I mean, South Park is the same way, right? South Park has no positive messages in it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But that's not to say it's propaganda.
Yeah, and it's owned by one of the largest media conglomerates.
Well, everything is. Everything is.
True.
You know?
Yep.
If it's media and you didn't download it for free on the internet, there's a good chance that a mega corporation had some involvement with it at some
point. Well, and to get this quality of writing and this level of knowledge about the political system, it's got to be done by insiders. It's notable that British politicians love this show because it's they're seeing their world reflected in it. That says something. And let's just fucking table this question of the propaganda or the non-propaganda. It's a good show. Everybody should watch it and think about it for themselves. So we're going to leave it there. And do people want to let the people, power to them, know what they're up to these days and do some self-promotion? Or Michael Gillum, you got some shit going on.
Yeah, again, I'm Michael Gillum. You can check me out on Twitter at News Nightwatch. I haven't tweeted in a while, but I totally will, I promise. And I have a new blog called Iconoclasm Today that you should check out. iconoclasmtoday.blogspot.com.
I got jack shit, so.
Right on. Jason, Gillum.
I didn't go to the Plasma Center today. That was great. You can find me in Blackreach.
And now you can't buy any smokes. Okay. I'm Ray Mangum. I tweet brilliantly at Man Ray Gunn. I'm doing an awesome music podcast at interplanetarymusic.blogspot.com. And that's about it. We're going to go out on this quote today from H.L. Mencken, a journalist of a sort that they just do not make anymore. "It is inaccurate to say that I hate everything. I am strongly in favor of common sense, common honesty, and common decency. This makes me forever ineligible for any public office." Thank you for listening, everybody. Catch you next time. Fuck! It was terrible. Forget what I say.
See you around the bend.
Yeah. Thank you for listening. All right.
Heads up, there's a frisbee! 1, 2, 3, now!
My notes are terrible, by the way.
Does that say leeks? As in E-E-K-S? As in you were
yeah, I wanted to. I want to eat some leeks. I wish
I had like some really cutting, like thick of it.
Well,
you know, cuss words to fling at you right now. I just don't. So.
Well, you failed too. Then you're.
I failed. I'm a fucking failure. Fuck, cunt.
You should
slop.